Today on the 21st Show, President-elect Donald Trump has nominated Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to lead the federal government agency responsible for public health, disease research, food safety, and regulating medicine.
And I'm going to let him go wild on health. I'm going to let him go wild on the food. I'm going to let him go wild on medicines.
An opponent of vaccines and other public health interventions, RFK Jr. is part of a broader movement pushing an agenda they say will, quote, make America healthy again. We'll talk over some of their ideas with public health experts. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. Airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in Rockford DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Raw milk has been making headlines lately. One reason is that, yes, unpasteurized dairy does pose serious health risks. There was a recall last week of raw milk in California over bird flu. But another reason unpasteurized dairy seems to be having a moment is that President-elect Donald Trump's selection to head the Department of Health and Human Services is Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and he is a raw milk fan.
Since I was here last year, I only drank raw milk.
And it's not just Kennedy's views on milk that go against health guidance from the CDC and FDA. The former independent presidential candidate, environmental lawyer, and nephew to John F. Kennedy has long been an outspoken opponent of life-saving vaccines. Here he is on Fox News last December.
Well, I do believe that autism does come from vaccines. But I think most of the things that people believe about my opinions about vaccines are wrong.
On today's program, we're going to talk about RFK Jr.'s so-called MAHA movement, or Make America Healthy Again. What do public health experts think about those plans? And what effects would we see here in Illinois? Joining us today from Chicago is Dr. Emily Landon. She's an associate professor of medicine and executive director of infection prevention and control at the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine. Dr. Landon, welcome back to the 21st Show.
Hi, Claire. Happy to be here.
Also joining us is Professor David Rosner. His research at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health focuses on the intersection of public health and social history. Professor Rosner, thank you for joining us.
Nice to be here.
And joining us from Washington is Wall Street Journal reporter Christina Peterson. She covers food and agriculture policy. Christina, thank you for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can join us today at 800-222-9455. How do you feel about RFK Jr. taking charge of American health policy, assuming he's confirmed, that is? What questions do you have about RFK Jr.'s nomination and what it could mean for public health? Give us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right, Christina, I want to start with you. I mentioned Trump has nominated RFK Jr. for the Secretary of Health and Human Services. What exactly would he oversee in that position?
Well, HHS is an enormous agency that has a broad range of authority over essentially the U.S. health system. From a food and ag perspective, one of the interesting time elements coming up is the U.S. dietary guidelines are expected to be updated in 2025. And traditionally, USDA and HHS alternate which agency takes the lead. Next year, HHS is in charge. So just looking at sort of one element of what he's talked about a lot, improving the American diet, he could potentially have a big impact on that next year through the dietary guidelines. And I'm sure the other guests could maybe talk a little bit more about sort of the broad medical recommendations that he will have the authority to talk about, to expand on.
Yeah, because it's you mentioned the FDA and or maybe didn't say that exactly, but the food guidelines, that's one aspect. But there's also the National Institutes of Health and the Centers for Disease Control and a number of other medical functions of the federal government as well, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what has been the response on Capitol Hill to his nomination so far?
Well, we don't know a lot yet. He has not been up to meet with senators, to the best of my knowledge. And there have been a couple other controversial nominees that have so far taken up more of the spotlight, I would say. But there are some signs that there are going to be some lawmakers with concerns. There are some senators who have talked about the benefits of vaccinations who may have some questions. Senator Mitch McConnell is a polio survivor. And so we could imagine that he might have some questions about Mr. Kennedy's stance on the polio vaccine. Kennedy on a podcast last year questioned whether the polio vaccine had averted more deaths than it prevented, or that averted more than it created. So there's definitely going to be some questions around his vaccine policy. There are also some senators from agricultural heavy states who have raised some concerns and said that they are going to want to talk with him about his skepticism of some pesticides and his urging of moving away from agricultural subsidies and in general taking on big ag. So I think you can see some concerns there. And then lastly, I would say his position on abortion, which has shifted over time, but he has supported abortion in the past, is an area that some conservative senators have said they want to talk with him about.
Dr. Emily Landon, I want to come to you now, and let's maybe drill in on one of the more controversial health policies of RFK Jr., and that is his views on vaccines. As we just heard some of them explained by Christina there, he recently said in an NBC interview that he did not want to take away anybody's vaccines. A very sort of lawyerly way to phrase that. What are your concerns around his record on vaccines if he is confirmed?
Yeah, so Mr. Kennedy has a really troubled history when it comes to vaccines. He is not very enthusiastic about vaccines and seems to think that they do more harm than good. Now, of course, the bar for safety for vaccines is very, very high because we're giving them to healthy children and we're using it to prevent an illness, not to treat something that's already there. And so it's important to note that the safety bar that's used by the FDA and when they make decisions about approving vaccines is extremely high. And the vaccines need to be extremely safe in order to get through that approval process. And there is absolutely no question. There has been tons of research and tons of studies and lots of epidemiology that shows that vaccines are responsible, are largely responsible, along with clean water, for the large increases in life expectancy that we've seen over the course of the last century. And these vaccines have allowed more children, more adults to live longer and healthier lives. And that comes into conflict when we have people who really sort of overblow any small problems that there were with vaccines. You know, an important an example of this would be what happened in Samoa, where there was an error. The vaccines were mixed with a different medication and given to two children, and those children had bad outcomes. They both passed away. But it was because the vaccines had been mixed with a muscle relaxant by accident and were not just a vaccine. But the anti-vax community used that, and RFK was part of the response to this, that to encourage the government to shut down the vaccination program and really rethink whether or not those vaccines were safe. It took many months for that vaccine program to get reinstated, and about less than a third of children in over a couple of years ended up getting vaccinated for measles. And there was a huge measles outbreak then that left seven children dead. So the lack, you know, the confusion or the jumping on and the overreacting to a small problem related to an error or maybe an unusual side effect from a vaccine can have really bad consequences down the line. And I tell this story as a cautionary tale about how RFK and his policies, you can say, I'm not going to take away anybody's vaccines, but you can stop funding them. You can make it harder for people to get them. You can require that people sign waivers before they take vaccines, saying they understand that they might might not be safe, even if they are proven to be safe. These are all barriers that get in the way and leave regular everyday Americans who don't have quite the same experience and reading of the medical literature and knowledge of policy as the people on the panel here do today, might make them a little bit wary about giving their child a vaccine or getting a vaccine themselves. And we see that happen over and over again when vaccine misinformation comes into the media. So I think there are a lot of ways to influence behavior that could result in a lot of infections and a lot more illness and a lot more problems for Americans, because if the institutions that we rely on don't trust the vaccines that we're recommending for kids and adults.
Professor David Rosner, professor at Columbia, also the author, I should have mentioned this, Building the Worlds That Kill Us, Disease, Death, and Inequality in American History, recently published book. Can you put a little public health history perspective on this conversation, the role of vaccines? We heard that comment earlier that RFK Jr. even questions the polio vaccine, which many of us were taught was one of humankind's great achievements and advancements. Put some context on this.
Absolutely. First of all, I want to just second Emily's comments and Christina's. Vaccines are probably the one medical technology that is responsible for saving the life of literally millions of people in this country and countries around the world. I just want to put that in broad historical perspective, because today we don't worry about infectious diseases like we once did. And that in large measure is, as Emily pointed out, because we've improved the environment, the water supply, the sewage supply, sewage system, et cetera, but also the impact of vaccines specifically. I'm old enough, I'm probably the oldest person in this room, I bet. I can remember the polio vaccine. I can remember when it was introduced. I was an 8-year-old kid. And I remember the kind of panic that used to encompass my parents every summer when we worried about whether or not a cold I got or some problem I got was polio. In fact, I was in a polio ward for a short amount of time because of a misdiagnosis. The issue is that vaccines have literally wiped out our fear from, in this century, from smallpox, from diphtheria, from mumps, from measles, from a whole host of childhood diseases and polio to our general benefit. So I want to just put that in absolute perspective, that without these things, we would be a much sicker society. We would worry about our children every day. We would see deaths among children and among adults from all sorts of other diseases. So I just want to make that clear. So anything I say that sounds like I'm supporting anything that RFK is saying right now is taken as an anti-vax position. It's not. RFK's position really developed in the early 70s, really the period between the 70s and the 90s, and especially took off following the publication of a long debunked article that appeared in the British Medical Journal in 1998 that claimed that vaccines were responsible for the relationship between autism and the growing awareness of autism. That piece was later retracted by the British Medical Journal, just to make it clear. The co-authors on that piece all withdrew their names. The person who actually was the primary writer of that article was later, his medical license was taken away for having created fraudulent science. And that piece set off a reaction among many people who, out of the best of intentions, were wary of big business, were wary of big pharmaceuticals, were wary of science in general, and who basically spurred a movement that ended up transmuting itself from an environmental movement and a concern about big business into kind of a right-wing talking point that was used to undermine science and undermine the institutions of science. So that's where we are today, is in a situation where we have people who, some of whom may have had the best intentions, really believe that these medicines are all just tainted. And the reality that we now know that basically there's no more mercury in the vaccine that originally set off this thing. I mean, the public health community reacted to the public outrage by removing all traces of mercury from the product. There's a long, long history of our fear of mercury and a fear of other heavy metals and other contaminants that are causes and are known causes of neurological damage. You just have to think of Alice in Wonderland and the Mad Hatter, who was driven mad, we now assume, from mercury poison, because mercury is used in the production of felt for hats. The crises in the early part of the century over mercury among workers in Danbury, Connecticut, all of whom were developing all sorts of neurological symptoms. So there is that base, that historical base that helped set off a fear among probably decent people who were just terrified that mercury was in their children's vaccines. So this is a long history, and unfortunately, it's been transformed into a whole different thing. It's been formed from a kind of liberal left environmental perspective into, you know, a political entity that has really distorted our understanding of what vaccines can do and has created a situation where whole generations of people who have not experienced the infections of before the 1950s, who have not experienced the world before large-scale uses of various vaccines, have not experienced. We don't know what happens to us. We don't feel fearful of infections quite in the same way that we did one time in our history. And it's just
and we may find out again. I'm sorry to interrupt you. We need to take a break on the show. So let me just take a moment to remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We are speaking with Professor David Rosner of Columbia, Dr. Emily Landon of the University of Chicago, and Christina Peterson with the Wall Street Journal about RFK Jr.'s nomination to be Secretary of Health and Human Services, what he plans to do both around vaccines. A little later, we'll also talk about food and other aspects of health policy that he says he wants to weigh in on. And as we heard that clip from President Trump earlier this hour, go wild on. We are going to talk about that when we return. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And today in the 21st State, we are talking about the potential consequences of RFK Jr. taking the helm of public health and really the Health and Human Services Department in Washington, and what that would mean for Illinois and for America, possibly even the world, depending. Infectious diseases don't respect national borders, for example. If you want to join us today, the number to do that is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. We heard from a number of you. Christopher in Brimfield sent a text message saying, I think he's going to set back healthcare for everyone. He doesn't believe in science. It's going to have a very long-lasting effect on children. A sad day for America. Laura in Peoria Heights said he is not on the right track for anything except more disease and destruction. If the bird flu virus goes on into pandemic like COVID, all of those people will be getting vaccines then while telling us they're bad for us. We also got a voicemail from a listener this morning.
Yeah, my name is Liam, Springfield, Illinois, and all I can say is that Kennedy is a threat to public health. And the example of that is what happened in Samoa, where children died because of his beliefs that he got persuaded anti-vaxxers in Samoa to believe. That's it. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for that message. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455. My guests for the hour today are Dr. Emily Landon, Associate Professor of Medicine and Executive Director of Infection Prevention and Control at the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine, David Rosner, Professor of Sociomedical Sciences and History at Columbia University's Mellon School of Public Health, also the author of the recent book, Building the Worlds That Kill Us, Disease, Death, and Inequality in American History, and Christina Peterson, who covers food and agriculture policy at The Wall Street Journal. Before, I do want to talk about some of the other aspects of RFK's policy prescriptions, so to speak, beyond vaccines. But Dr. Landon, I do wonder, what could federal policies around vaccines effect in Illinois?
That's a great question. And it's really hard to know because the way the public health system works in the United States, which I'm not sure that many people understand, is that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta is really an advising agency. Public health is actually a state issue. And so the controlling public health authority for the state of Illinois is the Illinois Department of Public Health, and they get to make their own decisions. They work closely with the CDC, which is better funded and has more resources to help gather information or do larger studies or have input or do testing that we can't necessarily afford to do in each state, but they do get to make their own decisions. Now, some vaccines are funded through federal funding, some are funded through state funding, there is really honestly a way for any child and any adult to get almost any vaccine that they need to get without having to pay for it. And that is an important sort of patchwork of healthcare provision that exists across the United States, in most places in the United States. And I think we could probably amend or solve a lot of the problems with lack of funding from the federal government by shoring up the funding through the Illinois State Department of Public Health. And I know that my friends and colleagues at the Illinois Department of Public Health are absolutely interested in doing anything that they can do to make sure that whatever is missing or taken away from a federal standpoint is able to be replaced as best they can here in the state of Illinois, because our values are maybe different than those of Mr. Kennedy, especially when it comes to vaccines. So I'm hoping that in Illinois, we're gonna continue to see children able to get the vaccine that they need. But anything that we can do as citizens of Illinois to support the public health department, both your local public health departments and the state public health department, is really important, because that is how this work is going to get done. Less probably through the CDC with any sort of cuts that want to be made on the federal level, and we'll have to rely more on the state. But I think the state of Illinois is great for this and is a great place to live, and will be better off than other states.
Just don't travel, I guess. Okay, maybe that's overstating it. Let's move on to talk about some of the other aspects of what RFK Jr. says he interests him and what he might like to see some changes in. Christina, I'm going to play another clip here. There are some recent posts on TikTok about raw milk.
Raw milk was demonized. Why? Because these big dairies have sway with the government and the media. Obviously, they will say and do anything that will make them more money. Obviously, as a result of this, raw milk being sold from small, most of the time family-owned farms, were now deemed dangerous and unacceptable.
The government doesn't know what strains of probiotics are found in here. Like, the more and more I learn, the more and more I'm realizing the government is a sham.
All right, even Turning Point USA, which is a right-wing group that advocates for conservative policies, is selling Got Raw Milk t-shirts. So, Christina, can you talk about how the so-called Make America Healthy Again movement intersects with the Make America Great Again movement?
Sure. So the Make America Healthy Again movement really grew out of Kennedy capturing a block of the population that went with him when he endorsed Donald Trump during the election. And their alliance, which was really about their shared interest in combating chronic diseases, got this moniker of Make America Healthy Again, that united the Kennedy supporters with the Trump supporters. And he has embraced a slew of different policy ideas that are all sort of loosely connected under this MAHA name. But what's interesting about it is that it definitely has been an effort to shift some focus away from vaccines and more on food, agricultural policy, some kind of just very common sense ideas like exercising and moving your body during the day. So it's been a very interesting combination of some ideas that are very controversial to industries like the food industry, the agricultural industry, with other things that kind of people broadly understand make sense. Try not to eat too much processed food, for example.
And is this where you see some of the Democrats that have sort of been, you know, at least verbally open-minded to RFK Jr.'s nomination, such as Senator Cory Booker or I think it's Colorado Governor Jared Polis have said, you know, less condemning things or maybe even positive things?
Yes, that's exactly right. And they've been pretty careful, in particular Senator Booker, to specify that the piece of what he supports is Mr. Kennedy's food positions. He's not sort of wholesale endorsing him, and he has not said yet if he'll vote to confirm him or not. But he has said that there's a lot of overlap in how they view the need to overhaul the whole food system to try and limit the influence of ultra-processed foods, things like regenerative agriculture involving farming in a more sustainable way, pesticides, agricultural commodities, changing the incentives of the system so that people are incentivized to eat more kind of whole foods, unprocessed foods.
Well, I'm always interested in what Americans think about health and food policy. One of our producers found a survey from 2017 that found that 7% of Americans believe chocolate milk comes from brown cows. So maybe we need to actually do a little clearing up of some information about raw milk and some of these other topics. Professor Rosner, can you talk about pasteurization and what that means for U.S. dairy and whether raw milk is a, you know, is a quote unquote health food?
Sure. Just the brief history, very brief history of pasteurization is that it was a major innovation in the early part of the 20th century, following real crises around children who were developing tuberculosis from tubercular cows and cows that were identified as passing on tuberculosis, what cowpox and tuberculosis to children. Believe it or not, this is just a little sidelight, we used to get our milk from cows that were hung from the ceiling of tenements in New York City. They were hung from the city. They were filled with waste from breweries. They were so sickly that they used to be milk constantly. They're just milk machines. And they produced this milk that was so tainted and so dangerous. And it was sold on the streets. Raw milk was sold on the streets of New York, passing along a whole host of very serious diseases to children and to adults alike. Pasteurization was an extraordinary innovation. Having pure milk was an incredible moment in which suddenly we could feel secure that we knew where this milk was, we knew that it was safe, we knew that it had been pasteurized. So that's, you know, that's the very brief history. Again, this is another sign of the kind of confusion that so many people have right now about medical intervention and the positive things that have been done and the public health activities that have been done and the fear of big businesses and big corporations that have become kind of anathema in our life. The big agricultural businesses have so taken over so many aspects of our life that there is a healthy worry, the healthy worry that big business is basically altering our diets. You know, I love these facts. You know, in 1945, we ate about 4.5 pounds of chicken a year, each individual. By now, we're eating like 30 pounds of chicken or more. And that's become a mainstay of our diet because of the concentration of these industries and their in ability to shape our diet. So there's this healthy part of our resistance of these processed foods and any kind of foods that reek of corporate and scientific intervention. And there's a very unhealthy part that has taken hold and is being used in a political sense. So I don't know if that helps, but.
No, it does. You mentioned process, the pasteurizing specifically. That's just boiling, right?
That's right. It's basically boiling. It's basically making sure the bacteria are killed before you bottle it and ship it to people. So it's a very odd kind of transformation of a very healthy instinct that we have and being created into part of a larger anti-corporate culture that is misguided.
Dr. Landon, how do you think about that as somebody who is responsible for infection control in a hospital? Take it where you will, maybe. Yeah. I don't know. I am curious about this broader turn against the health establishment, right? There was that book, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago now, The Interventions They Don't Want You to Know About, or The Cures They Don't Want You to Know. Maybe you can take that on more broadly.
Yeah, first of all, I want to just say that there's a very fine line between probiotic and contaminated. And while a certain amount of healthy bacteria in our food is really good for us and helps promote a healthy microbiome, too much of the wrong kind can be downright dangerous. And with the outbreak of what people think of as avian flu or H5N1 flu in cattle, it is not a safe time to drink raw milk, period, no matter what. Like, do not drink raw milk. The benefits that you could reap from possibly having safe raw milk are way overblown by the dangers of potentially getting H5N1 and then spreading that or causing recombination. Just a terrible idea right now, especially. But many of the things, this is what's so confusing about RFK. There are many things that he cares about in terms of healthy eating and healthy diet and healthy, you know, less chronic illness in Americans that I think is really important too, and that you'd be hard pressed to find a physician who doesn't think that we need to be healthier as Americans and that there's too much corporate influence in terms of food policy and medical policy and in terms of medical financing and funding. And I think from that standpoint, you know, there is some common ground here. The problem with RFK is that a big chunk, if you imagine a Venn diagram, right, of all of the Make America Healthy Again things and then the Make America Great Again economic policy, there's this big overlap part where they have completely different, where they have diametrically opposed methods of getting to the same place, right, or to different places, actually. Because much of the MAGA economic, I'm no economist, but much of the MAGA goal here is to be more trickle-down economics, more corporate subsidies, more lower taxes, less support for lower income Americans, but more support for businesses so that they can then grow and help, hire more people. I'm not an economist, but that is what that is about. People should keep more of their own income and less of it should go to pay for things like medical research and things like that. But there should be less regulation. However, in order to do things like make food safer and have less byproducts and additives to our food, we need to regulate more about the way that food is given to, is presented and marketed to Americans and what's been created. And those two things are diametrically opposed. And I think we all know that when you have the parts of the MAHA movement that are pitted against and go in the opposite direction of the MAGA movement, I think we all know where Donald Trump is going to fall on that. And I think that unfortunately, a lot of the things that I find not so bad about RFK are going to fall to the wayside because they are not going to be consistent with the other MAGA economic ways of looking at things. And what we're going to be left with are these kind of fringe views about vaccines and misinformation and what constitutes real science, which I think Mr. Kennedy and I disagree very much on what constitutes real science. And I think that we're going to end up with those things being the part that are allowed to go through because they don't conflict with the other sort of MAGA way of looking at things. And I think that's where the problem lies. I think it's sad. I think it's too bad. I think that's what makes me worried as a physician, as a human, as a citizen in the United States. I don't like the way that's going.
All right, we need to take another break. We are going to continue with Dr. Emily Landon, Associate Professor of Medicine and Director of Infection Prevention and Control at UChicago Pritzker School of Medicine, David Rosner, Professor at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, and Christina Peterson, who covers food and agriculture policy from Washington for The Wall Street Journal. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can call in and join the people who have sent us text messages. We heard from Anne in East Peoria, who said lifestyle choices such as eating plant-based whole foods would make the biggest difference for chronic conditions, but the MAGA base has shown strong resistance to that message. This is at the point we just heard. Regardless, it would be great to eliminate additives in processed foods. It's a moot point, though, if we all die in the next pandemic. All right, join us, 800-222-9455. More to come here on The 21st Show in a moment. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about what RFK Jr.'s nomination for Health and Human Services Secretary could mean for public health in America. My guests today are Christina Peterson, who covers food and ag policy for The Wall Street Journal, Dr. Emily Landon, Associate Professor of Medicine and Director of Infection Prevention and Control at the University of Chicago, Pritzker School of Medicine, and David Rosner, Professor of Sociomedical Sciences and History, Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, also the author of Building the Worlds That Kill Us, Disease, Death, and Inequality in American History, just out, actually. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us today, if you have a question about what this could mean for you here in Illinois or for Americans more broadly, 800-222-9455. Professor Rosner, has there ever been an HHS head, or I'm trying to think of any cabinet agency head, who has been so opposed to the broad consensus in his or her field?
I cannot come up with one. People in public health are generally dedicated to public health and not dedicated to political agendas or outmoded ideas about what science is or what science isn't. They've generally been people trained in the field, who have credentials in the field, who understand how serious infectious diseases in particular, and have historically done their best. They've made lots of mistakes. There are people who have done terrible things in public health by error. We have the experience of the Tuskegee experiments and ideas about racism that have infected all of us, including public health people, in terrible ways. But nothing like this. Someone who is literally coming out with no background and who's essentially mouthing a ideology that emanates from his own particular and peculiar understanding of environmental science and public health.
And we got a text message from Rhonda in Pomona, who said, seems likely he had or has poor cleanliness habits, about RFK Jr. He gives additional meaning to the phrase, physician, heal thyself. To that point you were just making, he's not a physician. He's not an expert in public health. He's an attorney, right, who specialized in environmental work for a long time.
Exactly. And he's coming from an experience in which there is a healthy skepticism of what we've done to our environment and what we've done to ourselves. But he's transforming it into a much broader analysis that has really no bearing in science. And that's the tragedy, that he's basically weakening not just the institutions of public health, but the public support for public health, the public understanding of public health. Because public health is basically a population-based field that depends upon all of us acting to protect each other. It's a communal activity. And here he's basically saying, don't worry about it. You go out and make your decisions about vaccines. Maybe we'll give it to you, maybe we won't. But he's basically undermining our faith in the ideas that we as scholars and experts and people who've studied this field and lived through this field for decades have experienced. And it's just tragic, because I think that's the biggest impact. It's not so much on what will happen to the institutions. It's the fact that nobody will trust those institutions. And that's all of public health is dependent upon, public trust. It's not like just going in and getting a medicine and getting cured once you get sick. It's prevention. It means we have to act in our own, all of our own communal interests of preventing disease. And that requires all of us to basically do the same thing. When they talk about herd immunity, it's a crazy idea that we're going to allow people to die in order to get a community that has natural immunities rather than any kind of imposed immunities through vaccines. It's just a very sad statement about where we are as a nation, as a culture right now, and as a society trying to prepare for the next epidemic.
Yeah. You know, one other thing I want to untangle, and we got a call about this for the sake of time. I think we're not going to go on air with it, but thank you, Paul, for calling in. This idea of chronic health, chronic disease, and sort of acute or infectious disease. And last year, RFK Jr. attended the conference of an anti-vaccine group and said he would redirect government research away from infectious diseases and toward chronic diseases. NBC News quoted him as saying, "I'm going to say to NIH scientists," that's National Institutes of Health, "God bless you all. Thank you for public service. We're going to give infectious disease a break for about 8 years." Dr. Landon, what do you think of that, giving infectious disease a break for 8 years?
Well, I do definitely have a bias in this because I take care of patients with infectious diseases, and that is my job. I don't think that's a great idea. We see patients, their infections are so prevalent. People think that infectious disease is not such a problem. And for many people, it isn't, because you get your vaccines, you do well, you know, you wash your hands, COVID is sort of no longer an instant threat for people. But then, you know, as people have other medical problems, they end up in the hospital, they end up having other things happen to them. And you start to begin to see how easy it is for our body to succumb to infections. We think that antibiotics are going to be there to save us, because now when kids get strep throat, they don't die. They get a little amoxicillin and they feel better in like 8 hours, right? But that is not how it used to be. And that's not how it's going to be if we continue to misuse antibiotics and overuse them in a way that results in more and more resistant organisms. And where, if we aren't careful about how we let these resistant organisms spread in hospitals and in agriculture through agriculture. We have to keep our eye on the ball here. You know, back in the 1960s, one of the surgeon generals said that infectious diseases was solved now because we had antibiotics. And since then, we've had a huge number of new infections come out, new multi-drug resistant organisms, new pandemics, new outbreaks. And I just think it would be really silly to let something that we have made such progress on and that we have so many answers for fall by the wayside for what? For what benefit? So that we can put money into what is the question that I ask. There's always a trade-off in any kind of funding. But already infectious disease research is amongst the lowest funded research in the country. So taking it off the list for 8 years or 7 years or however many years would do nothing. It would do very little to the bottom line. And it would probably be really bad for our long-term health as a nation. So I would say, I don't think it's a great idea.
Christina, talk about the confirmation process. You mentioned that to our knowledge, RFK has not been making the rounds on Capitol Hill the way other would-be nominees, I guess they're not technically nominees until Trump is sworn in, but would-be nominees have. Where do things go from here?
Sure. So we do expect him to begin meeting with senators on Capitol Hill in the next stretch of days or weeks, probably sooner rather than later. And then the Finance Committee will have a nomination hearing. He will have to fill out a very detailed questionnaire ahead of that. And the Finance Committee has, tax lawyers on its staff. They can really dig into stuff there. And he will have to answer a lot of questions from both Republicans and Democrats. And that will probably play an important role in sort of the sentiment around him. There's also this other dynamic, which is that I think Republican senators are reluctant to buck President-elect Trump on too many of his nominees. And so I think that there is going to be an interesting, dynamic here where we see if there are other nominees who end up withdrawing from consideration. Obviously, Defense Department nominee Pete Hegseth is facing a lot of scrutiny and pressure right now, and Attorney General nominee Matt Gaetz already withdrew. So I think that one interesting question is when Kennedy comes up for a vote, likely in January, You know, where will the sentiment be at that time? Will Republicans feel like they can't afford to clash with Trump again? Or will there be a sense that he's just confirmable and it's not a tough decision? Or will they feel the need to say no? And I don't think we have the answers to that yet.
All right, Christina, thank you so much. Christina Peterson covers food and ag policy from Washington for the Wall Street Journal. We have just a few minutes left. I think we can let you go. Thank you for sharing your reporting with us today on the 21st show.
Thanks so much.
Dr. Landon, as I said, just about 5 minutes left in the show. We talked a little earlier about what Illinois policymakers are doing, public health officials here, state and local, might be doing to sort of prepare themselves. What about individually? Are there things that we, those of us who do believe in the life-saving power of vaccines and interventions such as pasteurization, should be doing as we think ahead to what may be coming down the pike? Or is this one of those, you know, don't borrow, worry, see what happens and make our decisions as we need to in the future?
No, I think it's important that every American, I think, you know, David Rosner said earlier that public health is really a trust. It's a compact between people and the organizations that serve them. The most important thing that citizens of Illinoisans could do is trust their public health department and listen when recommendations are made. When the public health department says you probably need to be wearing a mask right now, or you should be getting your flu vaccine or your COVID vaccine, take those recommendations seriously. They are making them with a ton of data, with a lot of thought, with a lot of science, with a lot of consideration about what's going to be best for you as an individual and for the community. And part of the way that you can help serve the other members of your community, your neighbors, the people in your community who are sicker than you, who are less likely to be healthy, they is to follow the advice from public health. So I would say the number one thing you do is follow the public health advice that you hear from your public health officials. They are regular people like you and me who are doing their very best to make the best recommendations for you and your family and your neighbors and your friends.
Professor Rosner, just a couple of minutes left. We've seen in different places around the world, we talked about Samoa earlier, Gaza apparently reported its first case of polio in 25 years amid the fighting there and interruptions to inoculation efforts. You can't let up on public health, right? So what should we be looking out for if there is a significant pullback on some of these things we've been talking about?
Well, we have the example of what happened during COVID, where literally 1 million Americans died needlessly. I mean, we don't talk about that enough, but one out of every 300 Americans died of this infection. We weren't prepared. We didn't have the vaccine. And then when the vaccine took off, literally entire parts of our population decided not to get it because their political and their political leaders were telling them it was useless, it was not necessary. That's what the danger is. If, as Emily pointed out, if we don't trust in public health, if we demean people like, you know, Anthony Fauci, if we talk about people who've spent their lives dedicated to this field, and we don't trust them, and we go about deciding that, it's a political statement, it's a deep state that this is part of, this effort to get us to get vaccinated, we're in real trouble next time, because if this continues to take off, and if Robert Kennedy has the ability to sway even more people and more institutions to lay off the public health message, which is prevention is really important, we're in real trouble the next time a COVID or any other kind of infection strikes us.
David Rosner is a professor at Columbia University, the author of Building the Worlds That Kill Us, Disease, Death, and Inequality in American History. Dr. Emily Landon is director of Infection Prevention and Control at the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine. Thank you both so much for being with us today on the 21st show.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow on The 21st Show, Walter Broad was a teacher, lawyer, and the first black prosecutor and judge in Rock Island. But he also spent time as a doo-wop singer, and he had firsthand experience with the racial unrest of mid-century America. He recounts all that and more in a new memoir named for his mother. It's called Bessie's Prayer. That is coming up tomorrow on The 21st Show, which is produced by Anna Casey and Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Kulsum Khan. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. And Reginald Hardwick is our news director. We love hearing from you about what we have talked about and your suggestions for future guests or stories. Email us, talk@21stshow.org is the address. You can find that and every other way to contact us, including our voicemail line. It's all on our website, 21stshow.org. You can find us now on YouTube by searching for Illinois Public Media. We are also on Blue Sky. Just look up 21st Show there. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening, and we will talk with you again tomorrow.